Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 22 of Season 7 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard with a Vengeance, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is my good friend J-Dub from Dubsism. Welcome back to the show, J-Dub.
Welcome back. Thanks for having me. Yippee-ki-yay.
You do realize that the yippee-ki-yay is supposed to be at the end of the episode, right?
Well, you know, I mean, you know, it's such a great tagline that, you know, well, why not give it more exposure? Besides, let's be honest, if it weren't for the last word in that tagline, yippee-ki-yay, mother blank year,
mother trucker, as you said yesterday.
Mother Trucker, yes. It would be one of the most memorable movie lines out there. It would be right up there with Make My Day. But since you got the 12th letter surprise at the end, you get a little edited and then loses something.
That's true. But again, just if you say the term yippee-ki-yay to anybody, nobody thinks of Roy Rogers. Okay?
Well, not anymore, but you know.
Sorry, in the last 36 years, nobody has thought of Roy Rogers. All right. They think of John McClane.
Considering, didn't Roy Rogers die about 40 years ago?
Probably more than that. But yeah.
Okay. But anyway, you know, those of us that grew up on Nick at Night are the only people left who remember Roy Rogers. So it's all good.
That's correct. All right. So minute 22 begins with Schiller thinking he actually knows Simon and ends with Zeus giving an answer. So yesterday we talked about the fact that, you know, Cobb was trying to buy off Simon. Simon didn't want to be bought off. He gave his instructions. And after this conversation, so Schiller started chiming in about the fact that he basically said that all the answers are right there. Which is really interesting. I always find it interesting, you know, in movies when somebody picks up on clues as to just when a character says something, you know, and that's more or less what's going on here. You know, Schiller being a psychiatrist, it listened intently to what Simon had to say and has so many interesting things to say about it, because he starts off by, you know, he started off yesterday by saying that he's giving you all the clues to his identity. And he was cut off after he said the words, he spoke. You know, he spoke. That was it. You know, back to Shakespeare. That you didn't expect to get that 2 days in a row, did you?
Well, okay. So, yeah, you got me. I mean, you got me twice on the Shakespeare thing. But the other thing is, when we talk about watching these minute by minute, and when you start having that conversation where this guy's breaking down the forensics of what was said in that conversation, it's another thing that loses something in the translation if you stick to this strictly minute by minute. So it's good that you're, you know, giving the context of, you know, across the boundaries there so that you kind of keep the flow going. But if you watch that minute just by itself, you're kind of like, wait a minute, what's really going on here? Because I really get the sense that what's happening in this minute is really setting the table for other big important things to happen, kind of like you teased it in the last minute.
Yes.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah, of course. Makes a lot of sense. So Schiller starts off this minute by saying German. You know, and we're not talking about Sean German, you know, a friend of the show who will be on in a few weeks. No, we're not talking about Sean. And then he continues by saying he called it your Fort Knox. So, you know, he's giving us a clue that this character is a foreigner. And therefore, Fort Knox, it's not at my Fort Knox, our Fort Knox. It is your Fort Knox, which means that, again, he's a European foreigner. And he stammered when McClane pushed him. And, I mean, to me, that's a little bit of a strange clue for him to talk about. You know, so he's stammering. You know, like, what does that have to do with anything? I mean, he's not mentioning the fact that, you know, so someone who gets pushed a little too hard, you know, they might get a little flustered. They might stutter a little bit. I mean, even when we're recording a podcast, sometimes you'll say the same word over and over and over. It does happen. It's not because someone is being pushed or anything like that. It's just normal patterns of speech.
Or say things like, did that make any sense to you? Because, for those of you, if you want to start a minute-by-minute podcast drinking game, count how many times I say, did that make sense?
Exactly. We all have, our little vocal cues. I say the word a lot. I say basically a lot. I say a lot. I try to get some of them out when I'm editing, but sometimes it doesn't work. My wife always laughs at me about the fact that I always say, well, basically, it's something that I do in real life also, not just on a podcast. And that's the way we all are. So for a psychiatrist to basically say the fact that he stammered a little bit, I mean, he didn't even stammer that much.
Well, I mean, the thing here is that, this is where we get back to the minute by minute thing. And that is, you don't get the context of why the stammer is important in that moment, but
correct.
Now, do you get it later on through either that in and of itself, or it gets connected to something else that we're trying to use to break down who the guy on the phone is? That's why it's a minute by minute podcast. You have to wait and find that stuff out.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, I'll talk about it when we get there eventually. Also, it's not important that Simon stammers a little bit. That's just an added vocal context for it. It's not needed. It's an extraneous thing that's added into the movie in order to give John a reason to I guess make fun of him. I think that's pretty much it. But yeah, okay. But we'll stay within this minute. And at this point, Cobb then turns to him and goes, "Now you believe this guy really can't be bought?" So Cobb is still toeing the line. He's like, "All right, I got millions. I got what I need. I got a connection to the mayor. I can get whatever money he needs. So like, let's just buy him off." The truth is, I'm beginning to like Cobb less since I've been doing this minute by minute. I used to like him before, but now he's becoming a little annoying. By actually paying attention to everything that he's saying and the way that he's saying it. He really
wait. Doesn't he have to become annoying to do his job in this role?
Not necessarily. I mean, again, if he's following the lines in the script, then yes.
Okay, well,
but in general,
is that your way of telling me this is going to come up in your script discussion?
No, it's actually not, because I told you that as we talked about yesterday, this whole scene doesn't appear, so it doesn't really make a difference. But my point is that this they added in at some point into the movie, making Cobb somewhat weasel-like the way that he's dealing with the stuff. So I don't know.
Okay, no, that makes.
Like I said, I'm beginning to like him less and less.
Okay,
right. And then Schiller goes, "There's no chance." The very mention of money only enraged him further. So, which is ironic that this is what Schiller is picking up on, based on what we know about the movie. But but we won't go there. We're gonna wait.
okay, we'll wait. We'll come back to that.
Yeah, and at this point, Cobb then opens up the drawer of his desk, takes out a shield that's wrapped in a chain, like a necklace chain type of thing, and throws it on his desk. And John looks at it and goes, "What's that?" And he goes, "It's your shield. You asking me to be a cop again, Walter?" Again, calling him Walter, not Arthur. And then he doesn't really respond, and he just turns to one of the other cops, turns to Ricky and goes, "Ricky, get him his gun, all right?" And then John goes, "You didn't answer my question, hey?" And then he goes, "Joe, this time they..." And then John gets really upset, and he goes, "You didn't answer my question, Walter." And Cobb just looks at him and goes, "Are you done, Lieutenant?" And at this point, John understands the hint that he's basically saying to him, "Okay, now that I'm calling you Lieutenant, it means you're back back on the job. You know, now I just find it really funny that John doesn't recognize that that's his badge that he's throwing on the desk. Like, why is he saying, "What's that?" I mean, he's in the police, the police precinct. John wants to continue being a policeman. You know, he hasn't given us any indication that he wants to quit. I mean, it was taken away, his badge was taken away from him. He's on suspension, whatever. But he wants to be a cop because he's there. He wants to help people. He wants to do what he needs to do.
Right.
So it's just very strange for him to see that Cobb takes the badge out of his desk, and John's first reaction is, "What's that?" I think he's just looking for respect.
Well, and you see, this is where it gets interesting because you talk about this scene's never in the script, and I talked in the last minute about borrowing tropes. And here's another case where, how many cop movies have you seen where your action hero is in trouble with his boss and he's suspended or he's about to be reprimanded or fired? Or how many Dirty Harry movies is Clint Eastwood in trouble, is where I'm going. The same
Exactly.
feeling.
That's right. I mean that's basically what they do here. This is a typical cop trope in movies where someone loses their badge and gets it back in order to be able to go catch the bad guy, because apparently he's the only guy who can do it.
Yep, that's yeah.
And I mean you see it in Westerns also, where someone is giving back their badge. You know, it's the same idea.
Oh,
You know,
absolutely.
you're
Or
the
the reverse. The reverse of that is, Gary Cooper at the end of High Noon, where he drops his badge in the dust and says, "Peace, I'm out."
That's right. That's right. But that's the I mean, that's also a trope. We see that a lot in movies also, where at the very end the character has just had enough and is like, "Okay, that's it. I've done what I wanted to do. I'm out of here now."
Well, and I mean,
So
you could get all, artsy, filmy stuff on this. Say, the badge is, some sort of metaphor for, throw in something flowery and artistic there. But you see where I'm going?
yeah, for sure.
It just it, that that's a that's what it felt like. It felt like it was an attempt to go there with that. That's really all I'm
Right.
saying.
Okay, that makes sense. And then Cobb somewhat ignores John again and says, "Now you two better get going if you're going to go get up to 72nd Street on time." And then he turns to Lambert again and goes, "Joe, this time they go with backup." And then Lambert goes, "You got it." And then at this point, we hear them say, "Come on, guys. Whoa, 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 whoa. I'm not going anywhere. Zeus has had enough." You know, I love Zeus. I love the way that he responds to everything. And then the response is, "Simon says you gotta go." And he goes, "I'm not jumping through hoops for some psycho. That's a white man with white problems. You deal with him. Call me when he crosses 110th Street." Which, I mean, the way that they paint this character is, on the one hand, he wants to do good, but on the other hand, he doesn't really care. You know, he's like, "It's your problem, not mine. You know, if he comes up to my neighborhood, I'll worry about it then. Not gonna worry about it till then."
Which, I mean, is kind of a strange attitude to have if you really think about it. But, I mean, if you really want to help a situation, does it matter where it happens?
Correct. Correct. No, but he's looking at it from an isolationist issue. I mean, we'll get into it a little bit later. I mean, his last line today and the first line tomorrow will also explain things a little bit as to why, you know, he's helping. And then John turns to him and goes, "Hey, why'd you save my ass?" And then he goes, "I didn't. I stopped a white cop from getting killed in Harlem." And that's the way this minute ends. So he's giving a very straightforward and truthful answer that the only reason that I helped you is because I wanted to make sure that, you know, that a white man in Harlem is not getting killed, who's a cop, because it might cause other problems, which maybe we'll get into tomorrow.
Well, and
So
that's 100% true. And it also brings us to the point about, what is Samuel L. Jackson really adding to the mix here? And it's The thing that jumps out at me is that whenever you see a memorable Samuel L. Jackson role, for some reason it has to be exceptionally racially charged, you know. And this is kind of an example. I mean, there's more dramatic examples in the stuff he does in Spike Lee movies, and you know, there's liberal use of racial epithets in Pulp Fiction, but it just always seems to me like for Samuel L. Jackson to really come out as Samuel L. Jackson, that, you know, white man problem thing just jumped out at me. Like, that's okay. When I see Samuel L. Jackson on screen, that's what I'm waiting for. Bing, I just got it.
Correct. But I mean, in this movie, they correctly point out, and we'll talk about this much later in a few months from now, the fact that John basically calls Zeus a racist himself because of the way that he acts.
Well, I mean, you see the beginnings of that.
He's being an isolationist. From that perspective.
Yeah, that's all true. But you also see the beginnings of what's becoming the next example of a trope. And that is, you know, we take the two guys that can't see eye to eye and we stick them together. And that is, you know, that is the foundation of every buddy slash cop movie. It's, you know, if you want to even go all the way back to some things like the Defiant Ones or things like that, where you take two guys that can't get along, stick them together, make them force them to working with each other, and then watch as the friction creates new and fun sparks, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And that is the point here. I mean, and whatever, the two of them are great together. I mean, this is one of three times or one of two times that the characters are together, you know, in movies. So, you know, there's a third time where they're both in the same movie, but they're just not together. So that makes it, you know, do they have any scenes? I don't think they even have any scenes together. No, I don't think so. In Pulp Fiction.
No, that is true.
Yep. Correct. All right. That's all I have for this minute. Do you have anything else for this minute, or do you want to go into your sports analogy?
We can go straight to the sports analogy because we were just talking about it. And again, you know, as we were recording this, we are in the heart of the college basketball tournaments. And when I talk about Samuel L. Jackson bringing the racially charged component to the conflict between the characters, there's something similar going on in the women's basketball tournament in the sense that the dominant star player is a woman named Caitlin Clark. Now, if you don't pay attention, she's taken over the world in America. I mean, she's everywhere. She's on the covers of supermarket tabloids. She's clearly the biggest star this sport has right now. And it's because she's breaking records. She set the scoring record in basketball for both men and women. She's a celebrity unfolding before your eyes. But there's a lot of people out there that are saying that she's only getting this attention because she's white, which is complete crap. She's getting this attention because she's the biggest star in the game and she's the best player.
Makes sense.
That's where, you know, when I start hearing the Samuel L. Jackson, you know, white man's problems, well, that's a strange thing to say. If you're a guy that wants to help people, you shouldn't be given a shit where these things happen or what color those people are. And that's just kind of the whole point here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, she's a great basketball player. Do I care if she's white, black, Chinese? No, I don't. She's a great player. That's what matters.
Okay, and that makes sense. All right, so we'll get into the script. There's a little bit in the script here about what goes on in this minute. So it starts off with Cobb saying, "You can make it if you go right now. Somebody get out front and hail him a cab." Walsh hustles out of the office. Zeus says, whoa. Everyone looks at Zeus. "I ain't going anywhere." "He said you have to." "I don't care what he said. I'm not jumping through no hoops for some psycho. This is a white man with white man problems, fellas. I was a fool to get messed up in this in the first place. Have fun." Zeus is almost out the door. McLean's voice stops him. "He's going to kill a lot more people." Zeus turns, levels cold eyes at McLean. "I hope they're white." And he continues out the door. So that's pretty much how that's all we get from this minute. In the script, I'm glad they changed it. I think that makes Zeus an even more racially charged character by having that line in there. by saying that I hope that he kills white people.
Yes, that was, I mean, in my notes as well. But you got us there.
Yeah, I mean, again, if that was John saying something like that, then that would be completely plastered as being something even more racially charged. You know, if he said the exact opposite.
Yes, absolutely.
So it's a question of you know, double standards from that perspective. If they're gonna, you know, have a black character say a line like that, but if a white character would have said it, it's the same thing. It goes back to you know, we'll take a little bit of a trip back 2 years to the Oscars. You know, if Will Smith and Chris Rock were white, or one of them was white, everything would have been completely different. You know, I don't think if Will Smith was white, I don't think they would have let him stay in the auditorium to get his Oscar. But
if sometimes Will Smith were white and he hit a black man on live television, I mean, he'd be doing dinner theater in Guantanamo for his career now. He'd be done. I mean,
exactly.
That'd be the end of it.
Exactly. And so it goes with the double standard. So, all right.
I just feel like Ebony and Ivory should be playing in the background now.
Well, we did mention Ebony and Ivory last week. So, you know, it makes sense. Whenever I think of Ebony and Ivory, I think of the Saturday Night Live skit.
Stevie Wonder and Frank Sinatra. Yes.
Yeah. Well, no, it's they have was it Joe Piscopo plays Frank Sinatra? And I think Eddie Murphy plays Stevie Wonder. Yeah. So yeah, that's a great one. All right. So every
date stamp how old we are. We're discussing when Saturday Night Live was still fun.
That's right.
Oh, like 40 freaking years
that's
ago.
That's correct. That is correct.
I'm almost late for my Geritol here. We gotta get this
So every Tuesday we have a segment called Trilogy Tuesday, where my guests will give their top five trilogies. I know you hinted yesterday that things will be a little off the charts here with this one. So, you know, why don't we entertain J-Dub once again and let you show us what you think about this particular segment.
Okay, so here's the thing. If you listened to last week, the whole thing here is that I'm not a big fan of sequels and remakes, which makes the trilogy thing a little bit tough. But to be fair, there are two that I actually really, really enjoy, and I'm going to get those out of the way first. So at number five, I'm going to go with the John Ford, John Wayne Cavalry Trilogy, you know, the Fort Apache, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, Rio Grande.
Okay.
I'm a sucker for an old Western, and I'm a sucker for John Wayne. So those go on the list because those are not sequels. They're not remakes. They're all derivative of each other, hence the name Cavalry.
Yes.
I surf across one of those on my whatever stream, you know, whatever. I'm in. So those are on the list. Number four, the Godfather Trilogy. And now I know everybody hates Godfather 3, and I will be the first one to admit that when I bought the DVD set, Godfather 3 is a drink coaster at my house. It has never been in my Blu-ray player, nor will it ever be. Rob Reiner has a great line about Godfather 3, that he treats it like, I know you're not a sports guy, but even you know who Michael
Jordan of course.
Was, correct?
Yeah. He was a baseball player, right?
Okay, well... Yes. Yeah, he was the all-time goal leader in baseball. Yes, a lot of people don't remember that he spent the end of his career. Everybody remembers him as a Chicago Bull. Nobody remembers or wants to remember the last 2 years of his career. He played for the Washington Wizards, which was a terrible team, and he was an old man brought in to be a circus attraction, and that's what it was. But Rob Reiner's line about it was, I just erased it from my memory. It's like it never happened. Michael Jordan is a Washington Wizard just never happened. And I apply that rule to Godfather 3. Because even to make it one of the great trilogies of all time, it's like you can have two of the best movies ever made and then, you know, a ham sandwich, and it's still three great movies on average. So,
okay, fair enough.
Fraud Godfather 3 and just move from there.
I'll take the movie over the ham sandwich.
Yeah, I just realized I just, you know, introduced a pork product to a Jewish guy. That's, you know, You know, but hey, we were already dealing with
You're
racial
not the first one.
insensitivity,
You're not the first to do it,
sensitivity.
too.
Why
I'm
not
good.
just throw it right
I'm
now?
good. I'm good.
Well, you know, maybe I can open for Will Smith when he's doing Dinner Theater in Guantanamo now, you know? But there's gonna be a jump. There's gonna be a jump to my next series of trilogies, because pretty much all of these, well, number one is an exception, but the next two really come from the fact that my teenage years were spent with, you know, Cinemax late at night. So there's a bit of a, shall we just say, a body component to this.
Yes.
And I'll just get to the number three trilogy on the list, and that is, you know it, you love it, you can't live without it. These are the Casablanca of badly written, badly acted, badly everything teenage sex comedies. This list is not complete without the Porky's
I
Trilogy.
knew that's where you were going.
It just isn't.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair.
What was the dead giveaway? No, wait, was the dead giveaway Cinemax?
I actually watched it on HBO as a kid, but I knew where you were going because it's a trilogy. How,
Okay,
there aren't that
yeah.
many of them that are trilogies.
That's true. So even if I telegraphed my punch a little bit, you have to look at the Porky's trilogies just really for what they gave us. And you know, just you know, start with the range in these movies, because you know, number one is a straight up, you know, rompy teenage sex comedy. It's you know, and boob jokes as far as the eye can see. It's exactly the kind of stuff that makes you fall down laughing when you're 14. You know that
Yeah,
as
of
well as
course.
anybody.
Of course.
Okay. But then it morphs to when the third movie is like, oh, wait a minute. We've actually made a couple of dollars on these movies. So let's take this teenage sex comedy and let's go back to the theme of this episode when it tackles racism. Do you remember
Yes, I
this?
do. But that was the second one that tackled
Yeah,
it. The
okay.
second one was the one with the Ku Klux Klan.
I thought it was the third one.
No.
Okay, no, don't research that. Forget it.
I
Okay.
don't need
Anyway, the
to.
point
I
is
know
that
the answer.
somewhere in this trilogy, we went from the scene where they're, you know, describing, you know, calling in a police sketch artist to describe a cop, and the next thing you know, it's, you know, the Ku Klux Klan, and it's not even about blacks when you stop about and think about it, because this is Florida in the 1950s. You know, it's not about the race relationship between whites and blacks. This is about a Seminole Indian kid
That's right.
because he's in the school play and God forbid gets near a white girl, you know? But the whole point of that is like there's nothing better than when stupid comedies try to take themselves seriously, and that's just why we love this trilogy so much.
Yes.
Plus, let's be honest, the acting range by the husband and wife couple of Alex Karras and Susan Clarke should really redefine what Oscar-winning performances are really all about, don't you think?
I agree with you on that one.
Okay.
They do a good job
Yeah,
at
so
it.
yeah, no, you don't. Yeah, I mean, nobody should, but you know. Anyway, number two, same theory, three movies, the Caged Heat trilogy. Okay. Teenage boy, Cinemax, women in prison. Do I need to go any further? No, I really don't.
Nope.
You can draw your own pictures there.
You don't need
But
to.
the number one best trilogy ever, because despite my disdain of trilogies and sequels, here's one that couldn't screw up anything. Couldn't. There was no way this could be any worse than anything along this theme ever was, and that is the three Brady Bunch movies. Okay? You can't make those any worse than anything. Like, think about it. How do you make a Brady Bunch movie worse than the original series? Is like trying to say, how do you make expired milk more disgusting? I mean, you know, it is what it is. You know, you can take that format and it's like the Brady Bunch. What more do you want? Is you want to sit down and just hate yourself for 6 hours of why am I watching this? There it is.
Okay, and so why
Okay,
is that
top of the list. Asterisk.
why is that your favorite then?
Because it can't. You cannot be disappointed by it. You know, you're watching the goddamn Brady Bunch. You know it's going to be terrible. So no matter how bad the movie is, you're like, no matter how much pain you're in watching it, you just have to go, I did this to myself. I made a choice to watch this, and as terrible as it is, I still can't be disappointed.
Okay.
I mean, that's a pretty good guarantee for any film. Think about
Okay.
that. It can't disappoint me.
That's true. All right, I'll give that one to you. That's true. I enjoy them. I do enjoy them, especially the third one where Mike Brady becomes president, you know, so why not? It's a lot of fun. And they do bring up a lot of they make fun of the TV show over the course of it, and it's just great. So
Well, that yeah, that's I mean, that is its endearing quality, but still, you know, you enjoy them, you like them, Mike Brady is president, sure, why not? I mean, anything is possible. But you don't have on like DVD and you don't trot those up when you just really want to watch something. Those movies aren't the first ones you go to.
No, not at all. All right.
I would have been a little concerned if you said yes, but
I
hey,
would have
I'm
been
not
concerned. I would have
anymore.
been concerned too. That's true. All right. So, would you like to once again tell people where they can find J-Dub?
Dubsism.com, the most interesting independent sports blog on the web. Dubsism. It's a first page search result on Google. At Dubsism on X, the artist formerly known as Twitter. Dubsism@yahoo.com. Dubsism. I am easy to find.
All right, and finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for over a minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram, and you can find me on my website, moveyourminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send one to moveyourminute@moveyourob.net. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay, mother
Coming
trucker.
marching home again, hurrah, hurrah. We'll give him a hearty welcome then, hurrah, hurrah. The men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies they will all turn out, and we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.